So just to start off, a little bit about me and my practice, just briefly, because I want to get more into the content, of course. But as Allison said, of course, I'm Greta. My title is Clinical Ayurvedic Specialist. I did my training through the California College of Ayurveda. And my practice is located at 120 Cox Avenue in a building that's called the Embodiment Center. So it was One Center Yoga, and then it has recently been sold, and now it's the Embodiment Center. So my practice is in downtown Asheville. And I came to Ayurveda really as a yoga practitioner. That was my background. I also have had interest in food as medicine and herbal healing for a long time, going back to my teenage years. So I think that interest was there, and then I've been practicing yoga for a long time. And I think it was really out of my yoga practice that I developed an interest in Ayurveda. And certainly as I practice and study the two sciences, the two disciplines more and more, I really find that they are kind of one and the same, that they're like two sides of the same coin. They're certainly sister sciences. So that has become more clear for me with time. And also I'm excited to be here partnering with a medicine practice that is about integrative health, because, you know, Ayurveda is very much a holistic form of healing. And also, I think there's a really lot of exciting work happening out there right now with, people who are, welcome, come in, come have a seat, with, for instance, doctors who have a background in Western medicine and then weave in Ayurveda as well, or go on to study Ayurveda as well. I think that this is a really neat time in that way, that there's a lot of really great integrative work happening that's at our fingertips. So, what is Ayurveda? Literally, you can break the word Ayurveda up into Ayus, meaning Ayur-Ayus, kind of the same word, right? Ayus meaning life, and Veda meaning knowledge. So literally translated, Ayurveda is the knowledge of life or the science of life. It is the traditional medicine of India. It is perhaps the oldest form of medicine that is still in existence today, that is still practiced today. So it does predate even traditional Chinese medicine. And it's a complete holistic healing system. So sometimes people ask, who is a viable candidate for Ayurveda, or what kinds of people do you work with? And really, it's anybody. It's the whole range. So I can't think of a person who can't benefit from Ayurveda. Certainly I work with people who, are fairly healthy and who just kind of want to learn about themselves a little bit more and sort of fine-tune their diet and maybe look for some herbal remedies, some herbal supplements. And then I also work with people with much more serious and chronic and long-term conditions. So Ayurveda can also be a great form of complementary care. And the thing that's really great about Ayurveda is that it is based on the principle that our bodies have the amazing capacity to self-heal. So your body is always seeking homeostasis. It's searching for homeostasis. It's looking to find balance and health. And oftentimes, unfortunately, the choices that we make over time make that more difficult, right, for your body to find balance. So Ayurveda is really very much about giving your body the tools to become balanced and to heal itself. There we go. And some interesting foundational tenets of Ayurveda. So one, and I find this to be quite interesting and possibly quite different to a lot of the kind of teachings, the more Western model. Ayurveda is very individualized. So one saying in Ayurveda is that everything is right for someone, but nothing is right for everyone. So, obviously there are certain things that, of course, we all need to drink water, we all need to sleep, right? So that in some ways is good for everybody. But still, the quantity that we need things in varies. People certainly need different amounts of sleep, different amounts of water, even things like vegetables, depending on how you prepare them, it can be beneficial for some people and not so beneficial for others. So Ayurveda is a very highly individualized form of healing in that way. So, you know, maybe this is a little bit of a hyperbole, but what is medicine for one person could be poison for another. So, you know, poison might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but certainly something that's balancing, you know, a food or an herb or a practice that's incredibly balancing and healing for one person could really throw somebody else completely out of balance, and especially when those things are kind of repeated over time. So, and Ayurveda teaches that harmony equals health and disharmony equals disease. So by harmony, we mean making choices that are balancing and in harmony with your own nature, your own constitution. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit, and we'll get into, you know, a lot of details regarding the three doshas, the three constitutional types. And then it's also living in harmony with nature, so with the patterns of nature, with the rhythms of nature. So if we're living in harmony, then ultimately we'll have greater health. When we make decisions that are disharmonious, then ultimately the results will be some kind of disease or imbalance. And also, you know, in Ayurveda, we really look at everything that we're taking in through all of our five senses as potential medicine, or something that could be potentially harmful. So we really look at the foods that we're eating, you know, the herbs that we're taking in, what are the tastes of those herbs or supplements that we're taking in. We look at the smells, the colors, you know, the sense of touch. All of those things are tools for healing in Ayurveda. All right, so a little bit more on the foundation now. Yoga and Ayurveda both share the five-element paradigm of physiology. And that is that all things in nature are made of the five elements. And those five elements exist in a very real way, and they also represent qualities, certain qualities. So the five elements are earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And, you know, of course, yeah, we know that we actually have these, you know, these elements existing, but they also are qualities. So earth represents solidity and stability. And some of the qualities of the earth element are thick, dense, heavy, solid, hard, and stable. Water represents receptivity and flow. And some of the qualities of water are fluid, heavy, wet, soft, cool, and moist. Fire represents illumination and transformation. And some of the qualities are hot, sharp, intense, penetrating, and luminous. Air represents motion. Some of the qualities of air are light, dry, clear, rough, and erratic. And then ether is, you know, perhaps the most mysterious. It's essentially the space between things. It's also the element that holds all of the other elements because it's empty space. So in that way, it represents connection and possibility. And its qualities are expansive, light, subtle, and infinite. So remember those qualities. You don't have to memorize them, but keep those in mind because they'll start to play out as we talk about the constitutional types. Okay, so now we get to, like, if you've heard of Ayurveda, you've probably heard of dosha. Who here has heard of doshas? Okay, yeah. So that's sort of part of what's commonly out there in terms of information that's circulated about Ayurveda. It's kind of the kind of, you know, what's your dosha, and there are quizzes you can do online and things like that. So the doshas are, you know, classically speaking, they're like the three humors, or you can view them as three energetic forces. Dosha literally means fault or to cause harm, or that which spoils. So there is sort of a negative connotation with dosha. However, you know, your own dosha, your constitution, is not negative or positive. It just is. You know, we sort of have a natural balance of these qualities, these doshas, these energetic forces within us. However, when those become out of balance or when they become excessive, then they do cause harm, they do cause problems. And so that's why there is this sort of negative association with dosha. So water and earth elements combine to form kapha dosha. And water and fire elements combine to form pitta dosha, and air and ether elements combine to form vata dosha. And we each possess a unique balance of the three doshas. So, you know, we are each a balance of the three in some way, shape, or form. Some people have a really high percentage of, you know, one particular dosha, and then, you know, very little of the other two. Some people are really close in two and, you know, less in one. Some people are more equal, you know, 33% balance. But essentially, you know, we're all some kind of blend, and you're not trying to become something else, right? You're just trying to become a more pure and clear reflection of who you truly are. So now we'll talk a little bit about what, we'll get a more full in-depth picture of what each dosha is all about. So first of all, we have Vata dosha. And Vata dosha, I put that picture of the bumblebee because you can sort of liken Vata dosha to a bumblebee. So the qualities are, you know, it's movable, it's, you know, erratic, it's, I know the words got, text got cut off a little bit there, but, you know, subtle, erratic, movable. And Vata, people with a lot of Vata in their constitution, Vata types tend to be a little bit more, you know, they'll kind of move around from one thing to the next, right? So they tend to kind of flit around from one interest to the next, or, you know, switch around with jobs and things like that. So there is this sort of lightness and mobility to Vata dosha. So again, these qualities of light, dry, rough, subtle, and erratic, they come through in terms of the physicality of the individual and also in terms of the physiology. So when you think about, you know, how those qualities show up, people with more Vata, you know, tend to have a little bit of a lighter frame, finer features. Various irregularities can also point to Vata dosha because there's this erratic kind of quality, you know, so sometimes like a scoliosis or like a feature that's kind of unusually big, like really big hands and feet or big ears, that's sort of a marker for Vata dosha. And I also put like unruly hair, dry skin, so there's this, you know, dryness to Vata dosha. And it kind of extremes too. So sometimes like the very tall or very short will indicate more Vata. And some of the character traits are that they tend to be, you know, quick moving. They'll kind of learn quickly but forget quickly, you know, take up new interests but then kind of move on to something else really quickly. Sometimes they can have a little bit of a hard time following through with projects, but they will, you know, they're a quick study. They do tend to be drawn to things like art, travel, the spiritual pursuits, and creative pursuits. And when they're balanced, Vatas can be very adaptive, effervescent, you know, inspired, inspiring, enthusiastic. And again, this lightness comes through, a lightness and a creativity. However, some signs of Vata imbalance, so when they become out of balance and that Vata becomes excessive, then you get more of the kind of nervousness, you know, erratic behavior, maybe becoming kind of unreliable to the point where it's a problem. Things like insomnia, excessive dryness, and that can show up in the skin, you know, in the colon, maybe causing constipation, in the eyes, in the hair. And then also fatigue can be a symptom of Vata. So there is this sort of, like anything that's associated with depletion, depletion of energy, depletion of tissues is generally associated with Vata. And then in more extreme cases, when Vata becomes out of balance, then you get more of like the paranoia and self-destruction. All right. And then we have Pitta dosha, the bull. So I chose the image of the bull because there is sort of a fierceness to Pitta dosha. And also kind of a determination in that sometimes when Pittas kind of get going on a track, they will keep going. Like it's hard for them to get off that track. You know, they'll just kind of go and then, you know, finish whatever they're doing and then move on to the next thing and become very intense about that. So there is this sort of intense kind of forward direction sometimes and potentially a stubbornness with Pitta, although Kapas can be stubborn too. So again, you know, these qualities of fire and water show up in Pitta dosha. So, and with Pitta, you really want to think, you know, big fire and a little bit of water. So it's a very fiery type. And, you know, when we think about the qualities there, There's sharpness, heat, intensity, oiliness, and that all shows up, again, in the body, in the physiology, and the physicality. So pittas, you know, tend to have a little bit more of a medium athletic build. That angularity can show up in the facial features, in their speech patterns. They can be a little bit sharp tongue sometimes. Sometimes if you see more, you know, angular features, those are markers for pitta dosha. You know, also kind of an intensity, like people who have that really intense gaze, and also kind of a warmth. There is this warmth, you know, they tend to have kind of good circulation. You know, vatas can get kind of the cold hands and feet, and kapas can kind of tend to run a little more cold, but pittas tend to kind of run a little warmer and might have a more rosy complexion as well. And so again, some of their character traits reflect that fire element, right? So they can be, you know, more kind of competitive, logical, disciplined. They can be quite driven and also very perceptive, but more in terms of perceiving information, you know, not necessarily so much in terms of perceiving, like in being intuitive or perceiving emotions, but they can be quite analytical and quite good at grasping complex information. And when they're balanced, they, you know, they tend to be very courageous, disciplined. They can be really good leaders, good teachers. But when they're imbalanced, then that fire becomes too hot. And then you get more like rage, you know, judgment, workaholism, oftentimes issues related to the blood, you know, inflammation, blood, liver, kind of skin issues tend to be associated with a little bit too much of that energetic fire element. All right, and then we have kapha dosha. So for kapha, I chose the turtle. So there is this kind of sweetness, this slowness to kapha dosha, but a steadiness as well. So that's really an asset for them. They can actually, really if they take care of themselves, you know, Ayurveda teaches that they can actually live the longest because they do have this kind of steadiness and sustainability about their character and the way they move through the world. So they have those earth and water qualities. So, you know, heavy, dense, cool, soft, thick, moist, stable. These are some of the qualities of that force, kapha dosha. And so, again, that's reflected in their body as having perhaps a more solid or voluptuous build, thicker hair, thicker eyebrows and eyelashes, you know, strong teeth and nails, more kind of soft, rounded features. These all reflect more of those earth and water elements that are present in kapha dosha. And then their character traits go along with that as well. So, you know, patient, methodical, reliable, empathic, loyal, nurturing. They can be quite good in business because of their kind of cool-headedness. And again, when balanced, you know, they can be very kind of cool-headed, generous, compassionate, you know, very, of course, we can all be capable of unconditional love, but in some ways they can be quite, you know, maternal or paternal in that way. But when they become imbalanced, then that earth and water element, just it just becomes too heavy and kind of lethargic, right? So it's kind of like, you know, you mix water and earth together and it's like you get mud. So it's like, you know, lethargy, kind of holding excess weight or like having excess mucus. And then even some more character qualities like becoming complacent or kind of too stagnant, too stuck in the routine or kind of hoarding things for a sense of security. These are all indicators of kapha being excessive or out of balance. All right, so now, this is, you guys are a smaller group than normal, so we'll kind of go into one group for this. So let's see, first of all, well, you don't have to say which dosha you think you are, but do you, raise your hand if you have a sense of which dosha you predominate in. Okay, yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it's harder to tell. Okay. So let's actually, well, I'll give you guys, yeah, we'll just do this quick little quiz and then we'll do a quick little group exercise. So, you know, this is just, there's five of you. So this is just an example of a very quick kind of overview of, you know, some of the markers that we look at for the three types. And, you know, as I've said here, obviously that an Ayurvedic intake is actually a very, very in-depth process and when I meet with people for the first time, I meet with them for, 90 minutes to 2 hours for that, just that first intake. So this is by no means a substitute. It's just a, quick little fun glimpse in. So we'll start with this, and then we'll do a quick group exercise. So you can just go down the list, and it's and kind of look at some of these markers. And just for yourself, you can kind of think about what resonates with you. You don't have to fill it out, but this is just for you. I'm not going to collect these. Anyway, I'll let you keep those for yourself. And then I want to do a quick exercise here. So we'll just work as one group, and you're going to be practicing looking for some of these features in each other. So what I'm going to ask you to do, you don't have to move your chairs. We can kind of just swivel around and look at each other. The first one, let's look for the person who has the most angular face. So things you're going to be looking for here are like jawline, like a really defined square jawline, defined cheekbones. In general, just the most kind of angular face. So, and don't say anything yet. Just take a look around. Feel free to take your time and stare at each other. All right, and then on the count of three, you're going to point to the person who you think has the most angular face. Let's see. Wait. Sorry. Do it again. Do you? Do I count?
You said on three.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Okay. All right. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Yeah. I would agree. Yep. Yep. I would agree. Okay. And then let's look for. Now you're gonna have to look at each other's hands. You're looking for the most rectangular palm. And you can look for the longest fingers as well. So the longest, most rectangular palm. Let's just focus on that piece. I need to see your hands. Okay, and on the count of three, 1, 2, 3. Yep. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, and then the largest eyes. Sometimes people have to take off their glasses for this. All right, ready? 1, 2, 3. Are you pointing? All right, I'll go with that. All right, yeah. So anyway, that's just a little tiny glimpse in. About, again, like some of the things we look for, but it is quite detailed. And I think really going through that history is super important, and really having the conversation with somebody and talking about, how things are now, how they used to be, and then certainly getting tons of detail about what's out of balance and the symptoms that they're having, so I can get a better insight as to what the energetic, the doshic imbalance is when I'm looking at what people are essentially coming to see me for, which is, symptoms and health problems and feeling out of balance. So now the question is what to do. So we'll talk first about balancing Vata dosha. And I just want to say also that, again, this is kind of, broad strokes, kind of, the sort of by the textbook. I mean, I've added my personal experience, but that when I'm working with somebody, oftentimes people aren't just, stereotypical, straight down the line Vata with Vata problems, and we just do, balance Vata. That, pretty much everybody who I've worked with comes in, and of course you're going to be some kind of mix of the doshas, and typically their symptoms are going to be the result of a mixture of, maybe a couple of doshas being out of balance. So oftentimes, there is a lot of kind of fine-tuning, and that's where more of the complexity and kind of the art and science of Ayurveda comes in, that there sometimes has to be, more of a fine-tuning here. But this will give you at least a general idea. So basically, Vata is balanced with warmth, oil, and regular routines. So yeah, good thing to remember going into fall season, too, because fall is Vata time of year. So this is definitely a really good time of year to start incorporating some of these practices, really looking at having warmth, oil, and regular routine in your practice. And especially if you think that you might, be a Vata type or have some Vata type imbalances, Vata type issues. So, you know, things like getting up and going to bed at the same time daily, eating meals at regular times. So sometimes vatas can become, you know, maybe a little bit distracted, or their daily, you know, their daily routines can become a little bit erratic. So it's very important for them, though, to keep those meal times and those sleep times really regular. And then also for vatas, they tend to do better focusing on more warm, moist, cooked foods, you know, foods like oatmeal, stews, roasted root veggies with plenty of oils, and rice pudding are all nice vata food options. And then another really great practice that vatas in particular benefit from is doing a daily Abhyanga practice, which is a daily application of oil. And this is one of these sort of, we call them Dinacharya in Ayurveda. So it's one of the kind of daily self-care practices, and there are quite a few. There's tongue scraping and Abhyanga and doing neti. But this is a really nice one because vatas do have that dryness and lightness to them. And so classically, Abhyanga is practiced where you take some warm oil. Typically, it's a sesame oil, but there are some different oils that can be used. You would actually warm that oil up, apply it to the skin head to toe, and then actually let it soak in for about 20 to 30 minutes before showering. So that's kind of, yeah, so it kind of soaks in that way, and then the water and the heat kind of allows it to sort of steepen and be absorbed. So that's kind of the classical way. But, you know, I also tell people that whatever you can fit in, something's better than nothing, right? So even if it is getting out of the shower and taking a couple minutes to just put oil on and, you know, let it seep in and then go about your day, then I think that that can still be quite beneficial. So that's a few tips there for Vata dosha. Now Pitta, because it has that, there's that heat, that intensity to Pitta, what they really need to do is they need to work on cooling down, sometimes kind of on letting go, relieving their mental stress, engaging in non-competitive, fun, playful activities. So some of the foods that are especially cooling energetically, which are nice for Pitta dosha, are like the green veggies, you know, like your leafy greens, kale, even all the cruciferous vegetables, kale, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, collards. Green juices can be really nice. Also, aloe juice is particularly helpful for Pitta, for kind of cooling down the liver. Rose water is a really nice thing for Pittas to have on hand, especially in the summertime. So even having a bottle of rose water sometimes in the car or, you know, in your office or at home, just having that to kind of give a little sort of refreshment and cool down can be really nice. And then also Pittas, you know, they do tend to have a stronger digestion, so they can do more raw veggies. Those with a little bit of a weaker digestion, like the Vata types and Kapha types, tend to do better with less raw food. But Pittas can do raw food, especially in the summertime. And also cucumber and coconut are nice because they're quite cooling. It's also really important, you know, as I mentioned, Pitta dosha, Pittas can become very caught up in their work, even kind of workaholics. So it's very important for them to take mental vacations, to take time to kind of unplug, to spend time in nature, you know, take a vacation and leave the laptop at home and really just go enjoy that time away. And also doing something just for fun, you know. So Pittas can be quite competitive, and it's like once they get into something, they really get into it. So it's healthy for them and for many of us, you know, to just have something they do maybe once or twice a week that's just spontaneous and fun. All right, now Kapha is a little bit on the other end of the spectrum. So with Kapha, you know, there is this coolness, this heaviness. So they really need the opposite. You know, we always kind of bring in the opposite in Ayurveda. And that's why it gets complicated when you're dealing with, you know, dual dosha imbalances, because then you have to be very savvy about what you're balancing first and how you're doing that. But anyway, they really need, they're the ones who need that heat, spontaneity, stimulation. So think warm, spicy, light foods, you know, spicy, brothy soups. They don't want to have like the heavy, creamy soups, but like a soup with a clear broth that's well spiced with some nice vegetables in there. Some like steamed leafy greens, steamed cruciferous vegetables with maybe just a little bit of oil and some nice warming spices can be really great. You know, They do well with like dried ginger, black pepper, cayenne. And they can even do some of the drier foods like rice cake, popcorn, some of those foods that can be aggravating, especially for vata because it's just too dry in their system. Kapas can have that dryness. Also, more, you know, exercise is great for everybody, but it's always a question of kind of how much and what type. So kapas, even though they're going to be, tend to be less likely to get out and move than the other two types, you know, it's like vatas just like to move around, and then pittas have that kind of competitive nature. It's like they, you know, tend to like to move too. But kapas really need it. So they really need to get out, you know, to sweat, to do rigorous exercise. So things like, you know, really dynamic cardiovascular exercise, you know, more dynamic yoga practices are really what kapha needs. And then also just taking, being spontaneous. So, you know, kind of similar to pitta. Pitta is more like they need to be playful. And kapha, you know, it could be just being playful or even taking on kind of a work challenge that's different and new. But kapas can tend to get, you know, they're very steady, so they can kind of tend to get into their routine. So it's important for them sometimes to get out and just do something different. You know, go out dancing. All right. And then there are some things. The good news is that you don't have to have a two-hour consultation to know what to do. There are some things that are good for everybody, right, that we can all benefit from. So I want to go over the guidelines for healthy eating here. And these are super important. You know, Ayurveda, I feel like this is something that, well, I don't want to say it's a uniquely Ayurvedic view, but it's something that really does come up strongly in Ayurveda compared to some other healing modalities and forms of medicine. And that is that how you eat is as important as what you eat. And there's a saying in Ayurveda, it's not what you eat, it's what you digest. So, you know, you could be eating this beautiful, organic, you know, even perfectly doshically balanced meal. But if you're eating it in a rush, if you're not chewing your food, if you're eating too much or too little, then you're really not going to be optimizing that that nutritional intake, right? That, you know, if your digestion is being, if there's an interference in your digestion in some way, then you're not going to be maximizing the nutrition, and you won't be properly excreting the toxins. So these are just some general tips for, you know, how we can improve our digestion through lifestyle practices. And, you know, if you're not doing any of these right now, I wouldn't suggest trying to do all of them this week. Pick one, you know, work on it. So when I work with people, I give them one at a time, and we work on that until they're doing it like 75-80% of the time. And once you're doing that 75-80% of the time, then you can move on to the next one. But, you know, it's good to just, it's more important to actually implement the recommendation or the practice than, like, know all this and not do it. So eat in a peaceful setting without distraction, so no phone, computer, or television. You know, a little soft music is fine or pleasant conversation, but really trying to step away from the electronics and the work while eating is great. Another really good practice is, you know, it's kind of like a gratitude or saying grace. Just even if those aren't your practices, even just taking a few slow breaths before you sit down can really help put you more in rest and digest mode so that you'll be better equipped to really maximize the food that you're taking in. Also chewing, so we have, you know, lots of important enzymes in our saliva, and we can really break down, you know, start that digestive process in our mouths. So one nice way to do that is to put your fork down between bites. So this is just a simple way. Sometimes it's like, okay, how many times do I chew my food? I don't know. But, you know, just practicing kind of putting the fork down between bites can really help you sort of slow down. And then also, this one is a big changer for a lot of people, especially people who I've worked with who are working on losing weight, stopping at the 75% full mark with all meals. And there's an interesting little trick to that, and it's paying attention to the burp. And so this doesn't work for everybody, but I would say about like 90% of people will notice this, that if you are eating and chewing and paying attention, there will typically be a place in the meal, which is the 75% full mark, where you're going to have just a little burp. And it's not, so you'll have to, you know, if you're having dinner afterwards, you can try to see if you notice the burp, let me know. And it's just a little burp, it's not like a big belch, but that little burp is usually a really good indicator that it's, you're at your point. And I've been implementing that one for you know, several years now, and I have found it to be pretty on target usually. So give that one a try. If you don't detect a burp, sometimes people say go with the sigh. So when you kind of have that moment in your meal where you like put the fork down and sort of sigh, sometimes that can be a good indicator that it's time to stop. And then also, as much as you can, really try to not, you know, jump into work right after eating, but, you know, you can take a mellow walk or, you know, just do some kind of light housework or light reading or whatever it is. You know, a little walk around the block would be great if you're in an office setting. But, you know, really just try to give a few moments for that digestive process to get going before sort of jumping into something else. All right, and then a little bit on sleep. So like I said, there's so many different Ayurvedic practices. So I'm just giving you a little, you know, a hint here, and I suggest that you, I'm giving you not a hint, but really more of an overview. And, you know, I suggest you take one or two things and try to work on those and study, you know, how that affects you. So sleep is super important. Of course, we know this, you know, through, you know, of course, Ayurveda teaches this, and we know this through modern, you know, medical science as well, how important sleep is. And I know there's a new research about that kind of brainwashing process that happens during sleep, where there are certain neurotoxins that are rinsed out, and this can only occur during sleep. So it's certainly important. It's also a great time. Our liver does a lot of work. A lot of our detoxing processes happen during sleep. So we definitely want to try to get enough for our type. So here are some hints if you do find that you have trouble sleeping. And, you know, that perfect amount of hours is different from person to person. So some people, you know, doshically speaking, like Kapha types, maybe can do 6 hours a night. You know, maybe that's fine. Pittas, maybe 7. You know, Vatas, it might be more like 8 or 9. So you should feel, the goal is to feel rested when you wake up in the morning, to not be feeling groggy or tired, but to feel rested and to have energy throughout the day. So some hints to help with that are actually no screens after sundown. So this is particularly people who really struggle with insomnia. This can be really helpful. So really, you know, when the sun goes down, just turning the screens off and finding something else to do, you know, reading a book or doing some yoga or going for a walk in the dark, you know, whatever, but really shutting off those screens because the light does affect the release of melatonin, and that will disrupt your sleep patterns. If you can't do that, or, you know, maybe you're a pretty good sleeper, I think at least going for like an hour before bedtime, really trying to make that a no screen time. And particularly, really, you know, like for myself, I really try, even if I am looking at something on screen, like at least don't do email at that time, you know, like don't get wrapped up into work or something that's going to really stimulate you and pull you in. Also, getting up at the same time daily is helpful. So especially for people who have trouble falling asleep at night or who find themselves kind of going to bed at all different hours, sometimes working on that that morning time can be helpful for sort of setting the tone for the rest of the day. Keep your phone away from your bed and silence it. So even if you use it as an alarm, I do use my phone as an alarm, but I do try to put it, you know, I put it in a place that's not right next to my bed, and then I always make sure to silence it and have it silenced until that alarm goes off in the morning. So, or you could just use a different alarm, or no alarm would be best if you can do that. But, you know, that makes a big difference, those distractions and beeps and, you know, potential stressors and things that are going to pull your attention out of sleep. And then also some other hints. So, you know, some people have found success working with sound therapy or aromatherapy. So, you know, there are all different kinds of apps or recordings out there that you can get. You know, you can get white noise machines or do kind of nature sounds or delta wave recording. So there's a lot out there. In times where I've had more, you know, trouble sleeping, actually, like a lot of stress, that I have found that working with sound therapy can be really helpful. And sometimes there are, you know, timed recordings, things that will switch off after a couple hours. And then also, you know, essential oils can be really lovely for sort of setting the tone, communicating with your emotional, the emotional center in your brain, and really helping you wind down. So if you have a little diffuser, you know, you can even get like little, I mean, like $16 kind of diffusers like from Earth Fair, and or you know, order them online, and you can put a couple essential oils in there and have that in the bedroom and kind of diffuse like some nice lavender oil, some other calming oils. Can be a really lovely practice any time of day, really, but especially at night. And then also, you know, applying oils externally, like putting little lavender oil in like maybe a coconut oil or a jojoba base oil, and you could put a little bit on your throat and your feet and kind of inhale that, and that can be really helpful and soothing. And then also there's a number of herbs and, you know, zillions of herbal compounds and formulas out there that are very effective and helpful. You know, of course, anytime you're thinking about taking an herbal supplement, you just want to make sure to, especially if you're on medications, make sure to kind of run that by a health practitioner, because sometimes you do have to be careful with herb-drug interactions. But some of the ones that are really great are valerian. I definitely have found to be very potent and effective. You know, it's kind of a heavy hitter sleep herb. And then passion flower, kava kava. Ashwagandha is a really nice one. It's an adaptogen, so it's kind of more strengthening and stabilizing to the nervous system. So that one can be a really nice one for sort of helping to recover from long-term stress and helping to just sort of balance out the sleep patterns. All right, and then, you know, something else that I wanted to just add in is that, you know, some of these healing tools are really at our fingertips all the time. So sometimes in Ayurveda, you know, we can get into all kinds of complex herbs and complex herbal formulas, but there are some amazing medicines that you may have right now, you know, in your kitchen, or if you don't, they can be easily accessed. So I just picked top three here, but we could certainly have a whole talk just about the spices and their medicinal effects, benefits. So number one here, the first one is ginger. So it has traditionally been used to alleviate indigestion, heartburn, and also constipation. And actually a number of studies now, recent studies show that it is very effective at stimulating stomach contractions and actually increasing the speed, the gastric emptying. So the speed that your the food or the digested food matter, you know, partially digested food matter moves from your stomach and down into your intestines. So for those who have a sluggish digestion or even who have heartburns, because sometimes heartburn is because the food isn't moving down efficiently, you know, constipation, heartburn, things like that, ginger can be really great. It is also effective in treating nausea. So it suppresses the vomit center in the brain. So that's why it's, you know, typically a lot of times recommended for pregnant women who have morning sickness. And I actually recommended some ginger and black pepper tea to a client who was going on a boat trip who normally got seasickness, and it worked. So she didn't have to take her the medications, and she just took the ginger, and actually that was effective. So it's quite effective in that way. It's also an excellent anti-inflammatory. You know, it's great for reducing joint pain, premenstrual discomfort. So one study showed that for treating exercise-induced muscle pain, taking 2 grams daily of ginger powder was significantly reduce the pain. And some ways to use ginger, there are really so many different ways. You know, you could just get ginger powder and incorporate that into your soups or stews or saute, you know, when you saute your vegetables or do curries, make sure you have a little ginger in there. You could even just do a simple ginger tea, just taking, you know, ginger powder and putting, you know, a quarter to a half teaspoon in a cup of hot water and maybe a little pinch of another spice and just do a simple ginger tea. And then also you can, of course, grate the fresh root and do a ginger tea that way. You know, make a ginger tea with the fresh root and give that some time to kind of boil. I make chai most mornings, so I like to add a little. I'll get like a, you know, a mixture of course the black tea and some of the dried spices, but then sometimes I like to grate in a little fresh ginger into my chai too, and that's just another great way to take some, to take advantage of the kitchen pharmacy and also to add a little boost to your chai. All right, and then we have cinnamon. So cinnamon is traditionally used as a digestive. It's also antimicrobial, meaning it helps to kill off pathogens, and it's helpful for circulation and heart health. So studies have proven, so speaking to the antimicrobial piece, studies have proven its antibacterial and antifungal properties. Cinnamon is shown to be effective at inhibiting the growth of the fungus Candida albicans. So that was a study where there was, I think it was actually an oral form of Candida that this cinnamon was effective at inhibiting the growth of. It's also very anti-inflammatory, so it helps with a lot of metabolic disorders, helps stabilize blood sugar, you know, working with high cholesterol, high blood sugar, also polycystic ovary syndrome. And this is one of my recent kind of most favorite ways to cook with cinnamon. And again, it's one of those spices that, you know, you could put it in so many things. You could even put a little bit in some of your savory dishes. But one of my faves is, I like to do this as kind of like a light breakfast where you do, it's ghee fried apples. So you take ghee, which is clarified butter, and you can make it yourself or buy it at the store. Take like a scoop of ghee, put it in a pan, and then just take one or two apples, thin slice them up, and then you're just gonna like saute, kind of fry the apples, and then you can do a little spice in there. It takes maybe 5 minutes. You can throw in some cinnamon, maybe a little cardamom and ginger also, and you know, just add a little water as needed. Sometimes it'll start to stick, so you add a little water. You can even put the lid on it, and it takes maybe 5 minutes, and it's a super simple, lovely meal. Very nice for the fall, and another great way to incorporate cinnamon. And there are two different types of cinnamon out there. So there's the true cinnamon and then the cassia. And true cinnamon's a little bit more expensive, but the good thing to know is that they actually have the same health benefits. The only thing to know, and this doesn't really affect us in a practical way, is that the cassia, if you have very, very high amounts, there can be some kind of negative health effects. To be honest, I can't remember exactly what they are because that amount is so kind of ridiculous that it's nothing I wouldn't worry about it. It's nothing you would run into. So, you know, you can see what you like, but either one has a lot of great health benefits. All right, and then turmeric. I had to put in turmeric because it's become so popular these days, and even like golden milk, you know, the turmeric, I don't know if you know, the turmeric milk has become kind of trendy. So people taking turmeric supplements. So anyway, it is an amazing root, so it's popular for good reason. It's traditionally used as a blood cleanser, so what we call an alterative in herbalism. It's great for balancing the gut flora, good for long-term mental health. Some studies have shown a third of a teaspoon a day, and you could do more. More turmeric is not going to hurt you. That it's been shown to be as effective as prescription anti-inflammatories. It contains antioxidants, and it stimulates your own body's ability to produce its own antioxidants. There are also a number of studies that show it to be very effective at fighting cancer, so that's pretty big. And turmeric, again, it's one of those things that, you know, especially if you kind of gravitate towards Indian cooking, you can put it in everything. You can't overdo it. Unless you don't like it. In that case, then you could take the New Chapter turmeric for a supplement. So there are various turmeric supplements out there. That one is a good one just because of the way that it's processed. It's a little bit more easy for our bodies to absorb and digest. So a couple things to know about turmeric is that having it with fat, some kind of lipid, and also with a little black pepper greatly increases its bioavailability. So it'll be much more useful to you if you take your turmeric with some kind of fat and some black pepper. I like to have golden milk, which is super easy to do. You don't even have to use cow's milk. You can use whatever kind of milk you use. I like cow's milk, but you just take a little saucepan, put a cup or however much golden milk, you know, you want, put a cup of milk in there, bring that milk to kind of a slow boil. Once it hits the edge of boiling, then you're going to put in like, you know, half a teaspoon of some dried turmeric. You can put a little cardamom, a little cinnamon, a little ginger, whatever you want in there. Bring it till it just starts to boil, and then you turn the heat off, pour it into a mug, and then you can put in a little maple syrup and honey. So tons, if you just Google, you know, golden milk, you'll see tons of recipes out there, but it's a great, super simple thing. So to wrap up, you know, what we're trying to do in Ayurveda is we're not going to change who we are, right? We have our prakriti and our vikriti, what we're born with, what we've done to ourselves, meaning our current state, and we're just trying to get back to our true nature, to be a clear, pure reflection of ourselves, right? And in conclusion, you know, I just have been kind of reflecting on this in the last week, that it's like really yoga, Ayurveda, and I think modern science at its best, and integrative health surely, are really after, you know, answering these same types of questions, right? It's like we're trying to understand, okay, who are we? You know, what are we made of? And then how can we feel better, be better, and live better? So whether you're looking at, you know, what you're made of on a more micro level or a more macro level, essentially, what Ayurveda is taking us to is, you know, what is our constitutional makeup? You know, what are we, who are we, and how can we live in greater harmony with ourselves and with nature? So we will conclude there. Thank you so much for your attention. I'm here, you know, I can take questions. Also, I